And for the most part, the city seemed to be functioning pretty normally, but you could see evident the signs of destruction, great destruction that Israel had wrought during its bombing campaign of Lebanon, which included, swaths of Beirut. In fact, as you come in from the airport, or at least the direction I came in from the airport, you enter a neighborhood called Dahiya, and that got the lion's share of the bombing because that's a Shiite neighborhood. And I spent some time there and saw the ruins of many buildings there. I mean, just buildings, homes that were, brought to dust by the bombings. But what I will say is the people there are very defiant. You know, they're like, hey, yeah, my house was just destroyed, but we're still fighting and we will prevail.
Well, and that place that you mentioned, Dahiya, that has an extra poignancy in so much as it being the namesake of the Dahiya doctrine of the IDF, the Israel so-called Defense Forces.
No, absolutely. Based on,
do you want to reiterate what that name means?
Well, as I recall it, they have, that doctrine points to their willingness to sacrifice civilians in the interest of, their various wars of conquest. And they certainly did that there. That I believe that's where Nasrallah ended up being killed, and Israel ended up killing hundreds of people in order to kill him. They just dropped huge tonnage of bombs, just destroying whole neighborhoods to get to him.
Yeah, well, and when I say that that Lebanon has fallen off the media radar somewhat, with Syria and everything else going on, as has Gaza to some extent too, at least in the West. This crime of killing Nasrallah, dropping whole apartment blocks, and then Israel bombing in Beirut dozens of apartment blocks, killing thousands of Lebanese and making tens of thousands, more than a million, as it turns out, homeless. What's the situation like in Beirut now? I mean, is it tents everywhere, or have people dispersed to relatives in far-flung corners? Or, I mean, it's a small country after all.
From what I could tell, no. I mean, here it's a country that's used to war. I mean, and the people, for example, in areas like Dahiya that got really hit hard, they're taken in by families, usually nearby, while they rebuild. And by the way, rebuilding's already happening. In fact, Hezbollah's offered to help pay for the rebuilding of homes, by the way, regardless of what religion you practice. You could be a Christian, Shia, Sunni. And in fact, they're paying up to $40,000 to help people rebuild. And people are rebuilding. I mean, there's a very incredible resilience amongst the people there in Lebanon. And again, there's a brisk nightlife. Even now, I think there's a certain relief that at least for now, there's a ceasefire. And that's true, though, as you know, in that part of Lebanon. In the south, Israel, they violated the ceasefire about 1,000 times. They're taking over land there that's Lebanese land. That's another story. But in Beirut, things are fairly, for the most part, incredibly, they're normal.
So I just find that really hard to imagine. I'm looking at my X feed, just did a general search of Lebanon for today. The Israeli forces in the south are knocking down houses, blowing up churches and mosques. One commenter says that Israel used white phosphorus more than 200 times during its conflict against Hezbollah in the south. For a country that declares,
by the way,
well, I was going to say, as a country that declares as a doctrine committing war crimes and crimes against humanity, I guess the extra war crime of using white phosphorus as a weapon against anybody, but let alone civilian populations, is just a small beer.
Yeah, and what does white phosphorus do? I mean, what it does is it burns skin. I mean, it's a very it's kind of the modern form of Agent Orange, you know, that was used against in napalm that were used in Vietnam. I mean, it's a kind of a similar idea. And that's why it's prohibited. It's really it's designed to inflict pain and suffering on human beings. And again, oftentimes on civilians. By the way, I should mention, I also went to the town of Baalbek, which is a fascinating town, about 3 hours out of outside of Beirut towards the Syrian border, close to the Syrian border. And Baalbek's notable for the fact that it is the home of the oldest Roman temples in the world, the temples of Jupiter and Bacchus. So those ruins are still there. And Israel actually bombed on the site of those ruins. They didn't hit the ruins themselves. They destroyed a 100-year-old building that's on the site, but they hit right near those ruins. Still unclear whether there might have been some structural damage to the ruins, because we actually met a guide for those ruins who told us that he lives nearby and his windows were blown out by the bomb. So it's not clear whether there was some disturbance. But the fact is that people – UNESCO, which is the UN agency – in charge of declaring sites like those historic sites, became very spooked by the fact that Israel was hitting sites like that and threatened to prosecute them under the Hague Convention if they continued to do that.
And, well, I'm sure Israel is terrified by those
quaking
threats.
In their boots, right? Right. Everyone in the world wants to prosecute them, but we'll see. Yeah, if that happens. But Baalbek's an interesting place as well. The other place we visited there of note was the first responders center for the region, which itself is now dust. Israel bombed, selectively targeted that site. There's no other buildings around it destroyed, just the first responders building. They killed 14 first responders who had just returned from responding to another Israeli bombing. And this was – and there's a little memorial there with a – almost what looks like a scarecrow with a jacket of a firefighter there. But just showing the lengths that Israel's willing to go to punish civilians. I mean, in this case, not just civilians, but – civilians who help other civilians. And there was a in the rubble, we noticed a bag that was donated by UNICEF to the first responders. And again, all that was destroyed. So, you know, people need to know the reality of the situation. And it's grim. Very grim.
Well, and these aren't one-offs or accidents or anything. This is a policy. We've seen it everywhere that this military goes, you know, beginning in Gaza, but we've seen it in Syria and in Lebanon. You know, it reminds me when you talk about the first responders, which Israel was famous in pioneering the so-called double tap, where you bomb an area and wait for first responders to come and then bomb the responders. But that reminds me of 9/11. You remember when all the firefighters in New York were killed when the second building came down, and it was, you know, a big deal, and how people were. It was an extra poignant kind of tragedy of that tragedy within a tragedy, a larger tragedy, and yet now I see that Joe Biden on his way out the door is redirecting as way of not punishing Israel or anything else for this, but they are rewarding them by redirecting what this report I'm looking at says is $100 million dollars from its so-called aid to Israel and Egypt to redirect towards Lebanon to bolster, this report says, the ceasefire.
Yeah, we'll see what that means. Again, Israel doesn't seem interested in the ceasefire. They seem to want a pause to kind of regroup. But as I said, they continue to take over land in South Lebanon that, by the way, they could not do during the actual non-ceasefire, right? During the actual live conflict, they were unable to gain any land in South Lebanon. So they're using the peace as an occasion to do that, because, you know, by and large, the Lebanese are abiding by the ceasefire. It should be noted.
No, sorry. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, the other thing I just want to point out is that, you know, the other thing that people need to be cognizant of, that one of the things Israel did, I think, that leveraged the ceasefire, which got them the ceasefire, was that they started bombing neighborhoods that had no relationship to the conflict. That is, were not supporters of Hezbollah. In fact, some neighborhoods that oppose Hezbollah, Christian neighborhoods, for example, in order to essentially blackmail Hezbollah and the Lebanese forces into agreeing to a ceasefire. Essentially, they were making it clear everyone was going to be a target, whether they were fighting or not. And so a lot of, again, people had nothing to do with the conflict were killed in the conflict. And, of course, that those are war crimes, very clear war crimes.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Hezbollah and what's going on there in a second. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dan Kovalik. Dan's a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author and filmmaker. He's just returned from Lebanon talking to the people there. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against the Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. His latest is The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. It's a bit of a mystery to me, Dan. The collapse, I will say, I guess the people at Hezbollah would not typify what has happened that way. But how is it that Hezbollah just pulled in its claws? And what do the people in Lebanon say about the status of Hezbollah right now and its ability to defend Lebanon from Israeli antagonism and aggression?
Yes. Well, again, I think a big reason – well, first of all, a lot of the people who support Hezbollah – and the majority of Lebanese do, but there's certainly a strong plurality that don't, and I should say that. I mean, it's a very mixed country, again, ethnically, religiously, and again, so but the majority of people do support Hezbollah. And the strongest supporters amongst the Shia, first of all, believe that Hezbollah won – that is, that they got a ceasefire by defeating Israel. I think there's some truth to that in the sense that Israel, again, didn't gain any ground in southern Lebanon. They were, in that to that extent, defeated by Hezbollah. And, of course, Hezbollah was firing rockets successfully in Israel. So it showed an ability, certainly, in a person-to-person fight, Hezbollah was winning. You know, but where they weren't winning was in the air. Hezbollah and the Lebanese armed forces have virtually no power to fight Israel's air campaign against Lebanon. So Israel was basically able to bomb at will, and again, bomb huge neighborhoods, bomb churches, bomb mosques. In southern Lebanon, they destroyed the ancient church, for example, of St. Peter, St. Paul. Again, they bombed ancient sites. And so the other thought is that Hezbollah felt that it could not sacrifice all of Lebanon for its goal of helping the people of Palestine, which is why Hezbollah was fighting. Okay, let's make that clear. Why was Hezbollah fighting Israel at this time in order to support the Palestinians in Gaza? Okay, and they were very clear. Nasrallah, before he died, was clear up to the point he died that they would not stop fighting till the war upon the Palestinians, the genocide on the Palestinians in Gaza was over. However, again, they were put in a situation where Israel, which bombed Lebanon in a way they had never done before. I mean, that really with incredible tonnage of bombs, all of which, by the way, was provided by the United States. Hezbollah faced, you know, one, certainly losing political support, right, because if that bombing continued, because people would say, hey, you got to stop because or the country will be destroyed. But also they had a moral they were put in a moral dilemma, like, can we keep doing this and allow our country to be destroyed? And I think that was a big thing that led them to agree to the ceasefire. But also the truth is Israel had weakened Hezbollah as well. They killed Nasrallah. They killed other main leaders. Recall they had those explosions of the cell phones and pagers, which, by the way, injured and killed a lot of civilians, right? But it also did injure and kill some members of Hezbollah. But, you know, when you walk around Beirut, you see a lot of people without eyes and fingers from that. Again, innocent civilians. But it also did impact Hezbollah. So the truth is Hezbollah also suffered some weakening from the situation. So all those reasons combined are why Hezbollah decided to agree to the ceasefire. However, people who support Hezbollah do think that they are rearming, that they are successfully recruiting, and that they will be ready for when the ceasefire ends, because everyone thinks it will end. You know, they think that Israel, you know, that their hunger for war is endless, and that the war will start up at some point.
Well, as I mentioned, Hochstein, the American envoy, was very belligerent from what I read in his meetings Monday in Lebanon. I'm seeing on this feed that I mentioned earlier from X that bulldozers, Israeli bulldozers and front end loaders in southern Lebanon pulling down houses even now. So I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that Lebanon is losing ground even as we speak. There's an election there. Now, the presidential election is tomorrow in Lebanon. They've been without a president for quite a while, and the political system there is pretty complicated, and I can't pretend to understand all its ins and outs. But do you know, Dan, how important is the president in Lebanon? Can they, you know, they've been without one officially for this long. I mean, does it really matter?
Well, it could. I mean, look, if they had a popular president who brought the country together, obviously that could be helpful. As you say, they essentially not just don't have a president. I think it's fair to say they don't have much of a functioning government. It's very divided, and it's divided, again, largely along ethnic religious lines. You may or may not know, for example, under their constitution, the president has to be a Maronite Christian.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's worthwhile, Dan, to just mention, I mean, because the specter of another civil war evolving because of what's been happening these last months, that this is how the system they have now came out of the settlement of that the terrible civil war that raged there in the 1970s and into the 80s, if I remember right.
Yeah, we have a power sharing agreement between the major, again, ethnic religious factions. I think there's about six of them. And they basically rule different parts of Lebanon. So there's really not a central governing body. And as you say, there's not even a president. We'll see if this president will be one that has any power. So, you know, obviously that makes the country, I think, more vulnerable because they don't have a strong government or a military, it should be pointed out, to defend Lebanon. In fact, basically Hezbollah, which is not an official military, it's a militia, they are basically the ones who protect Lebanon. The Lebanese military has very little to defend Lebanon, is the truth of it. So we'll just have to see. Yes, and by the way, Israel was very open about the fact that part of its bombing campaign, and again, focusing on neighborhoods that were not supportive of Hezbollah, was part of a campaign to try to reignite a civil war in Lebanon. They would like to see the Lebanese at each other's throats, right? Because that would weaken the country. So I don't see that. I didn't feel that was imminent when I was there. I don't think that's going to happen, but.
Well, I was talking to Laith Maruf. He lives in Beirut, and he was talking about the Maronite and how the Maronite faction was very crucial in getting the civil war going and maintaining it back in the way back. But now the Pope had weighed in and talked to the Maronite leadership, and they had agreed to the Pope's request that they not follow that path. And so Lathe, this was some months ago that I spoke with him, was convinced that the Maronites wouldn't fall for this divide and conquer tactic to try to buy Israel and its ally to try to start a civil war there again.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think the Maronite Christians at this point are fairly friendly with Hezbollah. So, yeah, I don't really see it. I mean, obviously there's people that don't like Hezbollah that would like to get rid of them, but I don't think that there's anyone in the country that could really challenge them in a serious way to do that. So I don't see a civil war certainly as imminent. And again, I do think people have a certain amount of pride that they do feel they beat back Israel for the moment. But again, in southern Lebanon, Israel is, despite the ceasefire, making great inroads there. So, yeah, it remains to be seen. The other danger now, and we won't get too far into this because it's a whole other topic, is with the fall of Assad in Syria and Israel's great incursions into Syria, the borders of Lebanon are now very fragile. Before, Israel could only attack from the south. And now Israel has the capability, if it moved in from Syria, to now attack from the east.
Well, so, and the airspace being entirely open as well, not only for attacks against Lebanon, but against Iran, which is another concern. Dan, we're fast running out of time, but before we go, now you've had an election, I understand, down there, and there's going to be a new president in America.
Oh, you heard about that?
Yeah. Well, we've been hearing from this guy. I don't know. He says he's the guy that's going to be the president. I don't know. Seems kind of unlikely. He sounds like he's a bit of a Looney Tune, but he's got everybody up in Canada and in Mexico and in Panama and Greenland and in a lot of other places upset. It sounds like he's trying to create a continentalist vision of North America or some such. What the hell? What's going on down there?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly hoping, Chris, that a lot of that is just bluster. I mean, obviously, a lot of that is simply crazy talk, and I hope that's all it is talk. He feels a certain empowerment. He feels like he's got a mandate. He did win the election pretty handily, and he's flexing his muscles. But I really don't think as to, you know, the various countries that you mentioned that there's any danger of Trump making a move on them. But it does show, I think, that the U.S. empire feels a certain strength right now. I think particularly, again, after Syria, after the overthrow of Assad, which the U.S. definitely helped bring about, I think they're feeling emboldened. And, you know, an empire emboldened is a pretty scary thing. So, but I don't think Canada has anything to worry about. I'll try to put at least your minds at ease for now.
Well, in case you didn't notice, there's weird goings on up here, too. And our parliament is currently as effective as the Lebanese. There's no parliament. The parliament has been prorogued. The prime minister is getting out of Dodge, so to speak. Where he's going to end up, nobody knows. A few people up here care, I think. But it's strange days indeed, Dan. And I thought that the people that supported Trump were doing so because they didn't want to see America gallivanting across the globe, that they thought it might be time to retrench and take care of some of the issues at home. There's this fire going on and burning down Los Angeles, if we understand at the moment. Did you see, Dan, in that regard, the movie actor – our former movie actor, has been movie actor, James Woods was crying on CNN because his house burned down in the Palisades in Los Angeles, along with hundreds of others, a tragedy to be sure. But for James Woods to be crying about his loss while he put up a hashtag when in October of 2023 that said, hashtag kill them all, extolling and encouraging the Israeli military to wipe out every living soul in Gaza.
Yeah, well, there's, I guess, a little poetic justice there. I don't wish that upon him, but, you know, when you wish that upon other people, sometimes that comes back to you for sure. But, yeah, we have many problems in this country that need to be solved. You're right that the Trump base seem to want to prioritize that. They seem to be rejecting a bit the imperial presidency. At the same time, I think it's complicated, Chris. You know, the zest for empire and dominance runs very deep in the American psyche. And I think that Trump, in many ways, taps into that.
Madness. Well, complication is not what we do best here. This is radio, after all. But before we go, Dan, can you tell our listeners how they can order your books and find out more about the work that you're doing and your almost ceaseless travel, it seems?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for that. Yes, they can, of course, buy all my books on Amazon or from my publisher, SkyHorsePublishing.com. Also at local bookstores. If they don't have them, they're usually happy to order them. And to follow me, my travels and other things, they can follow me on Twitter at Daniel M. Kavalik.
Well, Dan, thanks a lot for coming on again. I've this many times, and I promise next time I'll pronounce your surname correctly. Maybe.
No no worries, Chris.
And thanks to Peter Eglin out east there. And remember to find his book, Analyzing the Israel Effect in Canada, a Critical Autoethnography, available at Routledge Press and Amazon and so on as well. Thanks again, Dan.
Thank you very much, Chris.
That's all I got for this week. Till the next time.
Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurdish people, killed thousands in a single day. 12 long years later, Uncle Sam said you can't treat Kurds that way. And furthermore, all Kurds are freedom fighters who'd resist this Iraqi tyranny. So Uncle Sam will give them guns and maybe sometimes ammunition so the brave Kurds can fight until they're free. Meanwhile, in southeastern Turkey, the Turkish army had a unique plan. We'll go burn down 3,000 villages, get rid of what they call Kurdistan. But some of these pesky Kurds decided that they would rather fight instead of die. So Uncle Sam said, "You are terrorists because Turkey is our ally." Yes, geopolitics is confusing. In fact, it can be quite absurd. Especially if you value your freedom. You live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when Iraqi Kurds are massacred, we say this is genocide. Okay, we armed the army through the 80s, but now we proudly take the Kurdish side. But in Turkey, it's an internal matter, and for us to get involved would be wrong. So we'll sell some tanks and copters to Ankara and hope these poor folks can get along. Yes, geopolitics is confusing, and you can't take the Yankees at their word. At least that's distinctly how it looks if you live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when we talk about American interests, and it somehow seems that they're not yours, going all over the world, bombing countries and starting up wars. You'd better leave it to the experts. Go on back to your PlayStations. 'Cause our foreign policy only makes sense to CEOs of multinational corporations. Yes, geopolitics is confusing. And if you feel like you're not being heard, just imagine how much worse it could be if you lived in Turkey and you were a Kurd.